Thank you very much, Brenda, and to the AGA and to the sponsors for this event, for this outstanding opportunity to speak with you today. What a better way to start the morning besides talking about acute pancreatitis. We have a lot to discuss this morning, so it's great that everybody's had a good bit of coffee here. I'll try to summarize these slides. A lot of these slides are here for your information, for your reference. I'll try to highlight the very important points as we go through this talk. So a famous British surgeon who went through World War I and did a lot of work during World War I once said that the worst possible thing that can happen to the belly is acute pancreatitis. And that's a really profound statement, but I think it's a true statement that holds true to today. So we're going to talk about today the definition of acute pancreatitis, clinical presentation, epidemiology, pathophysiology, its causes, complications, some radiographic studies, scoring systems to predict who's going to have severe acute pancreatitis and who isn't. How to manage fluids with these patients, antibiotics, nutrition, when to do ERCP. These are the key points in acute pancreatitis, and long-term complications of acute pancreatitis. Acute pancreatitis' definition is it's an inflammation of the pancreas and its associated adjacent organs, but without evidence of chronic pancreatitis. Okay, and I think a very important point is the Atlanta Symposium definition of acute pancreatitis. I use this on an almost daily basis talking to my fellows and how I think about acute pancreatitis. And it consists of two of the three following issues that may occur and are part of the definition. You don't have to have all three of these key points, just have to have two. Typical pancreatic pain, and we all know what that is. It's band-like abdominal pain, sits in the upper abdomen, can go to the back. Radiographic findings of acute pancreatitis and biochemical findings of acute pancreatitis. So you don't need pain. You don't necessarily need radiographic findings. You don't necessarily need biochemistry. You just need two of the three following. It is a clinical diagnosis. And keep in mind, biochemical evidence of acute pancreatitis, you got to have marked elevations in amylase and lipase. Mild elevations do not necessarily fit the definition of acute pancreatitis. Let me say that again. Mild elevations in amylase and lipase are not necessarily of pancreatic origin and do not fit the definition of acute pancreatitis. You got to be at least three times the upper limit of normal, okay? Lots of things elevate the amylase and lipase, and this makes it confusing for all of us. Things like renal insufficiency, we won't go into all these. A duodenal ulcer, perforated intestine can do it as well. A tubo-ovarian abscess, cholecystitis, and that can make things quite confusing. We won't necessarily talk about how to work up a false positive amylase and lipase, but it's here for your reference. Just keep in mind that when patients present with acute pancreatitis, an elevated amylase and lipase may take a little while to be measurable. And if the patient presents late, they may have a low amylase and lipase. So keep in mind the time course of when amylase and lipase typically elevate. What are the presenting features? We're all familiar with this, seeing patients with acute pancreatitis. They almost always have abdominal pain 95% plus of the time. Nausea and vomiting are very common, over 90% or so, around 90%. Tachycardia and fever are not uncommon at all. Some patients have painless acute pancreatitis. That's important to keep in mind. The populations where you see that are typically diabetics with neuropathy, people who have had peritoneal dialysis, and in postoperative conditions. So sometimes acute pancreatitis is diagnosed at autopsy, and you have to keep that in mind that we don't want that to happen, obviously, to our patients. What are some extra intestinal manifestations of acute pancreatitis? There are some other organ systems that can be involved. There can be a arthritis. There can be a paniculitis in the skin if the amylase and lipase are very, very high. There's a retinopathy that can occur called Purkinje's retinopathy. And what is the pain like in acute pancreatitis? Well, we all are familiar with this is severe pain. One of the interesting things about acute pancreatitis is it's probably the third fastest onset of pain, abdominal pain that exists in the GI world, the first being probably a perforated viscous where it's sudden, boom, onset of pain, and the second being a superior mesenteric artery thrombosis with severe resulting pain. Acute pancreatitis is almost as fast as those things. It generally starts within 10 to 20 minutes and reaches its peak within 10 to 20 minutes. Keep in mind this pain is not undulating, it is not usually crampy, it usually lasts many, many hours, often days. So somebody who says, oh, it hurts for a half hour, goes away, comes back in another half an hour, unlikely to be acute pancreatitis. It can be, but that's a really uncommon presentation. All right, so what's the epidemiology of acute pancreatitis? We know the disease is increasing in incidence, and that's There are a variety of reasons for this. We're detecting it better. Another thing is that we know that hospitals are getting a little bit more reimbursement for an abdominal pain admission if you check the box that says acute pancreatitis. So that's kind of confounding how we think about acute pancreatitis, but it's a real phenomenon. It is increasing in incidence. It's rare to have young kids with acute pancreatitis, but of course it does happen with traumatic pancreatitis, hereditary pancreatitis, or other anatomic anomaly. About 250,000 admissions per year in this country are due to acute pancreatitis. It's very expensive, $2 billion a year. Just a couple words about physiology. I don't want to give you guys glassy eyes with this, but I think it's important. You cannot have acute pancreatitis without premature activation of the trypsinogen molecule. So we all just had breakfast. Our pancreas produced trypsin. We got trypsinogen activating, especially if you had yogurt and, you know, some fatty things and some fatty muffins. And that trypsin becomes activated in the duodenum, and it does its job. But when that trypsin becomes activated prematurely in the pancreas, it activates other cytokines, interleukins, other enzymes, other zymogens. And now all of a sudden you have a huge inflammatory milieu. You have an intraperitoneal burn or retroperitoneal burn. You have polymorphonucleocytes rush into the pancreatic bed, and essentially you have retroperitoneal soup. You have a big mess. So that's the pathophysiology of acute pancreatitis as a review. What are the etiologies of acute pancreatitis? We are all familiar with this, but just a review. There's a rule of thirds, okay, and that's a real key point here today. About a third of the time, it's due to biliary causes. About a third due to alcohol. Those are the two most common causes. After that, you have it evenly divided between idiopathic causes of acute pancreatitis and also, of course, a miscellaneous hodgepodge of a million different causes, mainly triglycerides, drugs, and post-ERCP. And on here I have asterisks. These asterisks indicate the severity of acute pancreatitis. Now, this is not a hard and fast rule. Generally speaking, the first attack of alcohol pancreatitis is typically pretty bad. But keep in mind, things like infection are usually mild types of acute pancreatitis, other than things like the mumps. And drugs are also usually mild acute pancreatitis. Okay, what about gallstone pancreatitis? Just a quick anatomy review. Here's an ERCP scope in the stomach and into the duodenum with the common bile duct being cannulated. And what's happening with biliary pancreatitis is small stones are developing in the gallbladder, okay? And they come out of the gallbladder into the cystic duct, migrate down into the common bile duct and get lodged at the major papilla. When they get lodged at the major papilla, bile tends to reflux and get into the pancreas. When bile gets into the pancreas, it activates all the pancreatic enzymes prematurely. You get acute pancreatitis. Usually after about 3-4 hours, that stone passes. Patient tends to feel a little bit of relief. We all feel a little bit of relief. Usually don't have to do anything with these patients, but we do get lulled into a false sense of security, right? Because occasionally large stones get out of the common bile duct and get lodged at the major papilla. And when that happens and that stone is there for hours and hours and days, and pus develops, and you get cholangitis, right? Because cholangitis, as we all know, is fever, right upper quadrant pain, and jaundice, that's an infected common bile duct. When cholangitis occurs in association with biliary acute pancreatitis, that's when you get disasters. What happens is pus gets in the common bile duct. The common bile duct is obstructed for a long period of time. Lots of bile gets into the pancreas. Pus gets into the pancreas. Now you have a disaster. So one of the goals with managing these patients is figuring out who's got that stone that's still sitting there, that's lodged there. And it can be quite a challenge to figure that out. But I'm going to give you a few pearls here about how to figure that out. Okay? So some principles of biliary pancreatitis are, down here at the bottom, we highlighted this. So there's a sequence of events that occurs in the laboratory findings with bile duct obstruction. First of all, the transaminases increase. That's one of the first things that happens, though that takes a few hours for that to happen. And those transaminases can go up to 1,000, okay, although that's quite unusual. So don't just assume you have a viral cause of hepatitis. If you see an AST and ALT of 800, 900, that could be very early cholangitis. And early on, there's no ductal dilatation in cholangitis. It takes a day or two or three sometimes to get ductal dilatation. So don't just assume somebody does not have cholangitis if the bile ducts are not dilated, because that may not be the case. So first you have transaminases, then the bilirubin becomes elevated. That may take as long as 24 hours or more for the bilirubin to become elevated, and then the ducts dilate. Now, all this, the labs also lag when the patient improves. So as the patient improves, it may take hours and hours and maybe even a day or two for the labs to improve. So that's a very important point, that labs tend to lag behind what's clinically happening and what's physiologically happening when you look at liver-associated enzymes in acute pancreatitis. Okay? But don't be afraid to call a gastroenterologist in the middle of the night or a fellow for somebody who's got cholangitis and acute pancreatitis. They're febrile, they're sick, you know, we want to know about them. Bilirubin's 4 or 5, those are some predictors that tell us that maybe we're in trouble, or ducts are dilated, or the patient's just not getting better. Another key point that I see a lot of internists and general, sometimes even general gastroenterologists or residents make this error, is where they know that there's a biliary cause of acute pancreatitis. They know that there's stones in the gallbladder. They know the LFTs have been elevated. But they don't actually, they talk to the surgeons, but they don't actually document that they talk to them, and they don't document what the follow-up for the gallbladder is. All these patients need their gallbladders out when they have gallstones and gallstone pancreatitis. Otherwise, the same thing's just going to happen again 2 weeks later, a month or two later, and it could be more severe next time. So it's very important to have a note on the chart about what the plan is going to be with the gallbladder. So we talked about this, about trying to decide who has the active biliary stone present, and you can think about patients in terms of high risk of having a common bile duct stone with biliary pancreatitis, moderate risk of having a common bile duct stone, at low risk. And the patients who are at high risk are the patients who have ongoing biliary obstruction, they have a dilated common bile duct, they have cholangitis. Those patients need more, and high bilirubin over 3, often over 5. Those patients need an urgent ERCP, and you need no further testing. Most of our patients are at moderate risk. They have some mild transaminase elevations. They have gallstones. And those patients need some sort of ancillary study before you run to ERCP. Usually it's an MRCP, but it does depend on local expertise. And some patients are very low risk, getting better, and you don't need any further testing on them. So let's go through a couple scenarios here. I think that they're illustrative of my points here. And this is a patient, these are three scenarios that I've outlined here. The first one is a patient who's extremely ill, who is tachypneic and tachycardic and has an altermental status and is is lethargic and has a white count of 20,000 and has pancreatitis and has a mild, very mild bilirubin elevation, but has a pretty marked transaminase elevation and has ductal dilatation on ultrasound. So what do you think you would do with somebody who looks unwell, has a fever, has a little bit of a bilirubin elevation? You know, this is the patient who needs an ERCP, okay? Urgent ERCP, no questions asked. The bilirubin is not that high. However, it's going to take time for the bilirubin to go up. But if, you know, if this is cholangitis, they need an urgent ERCP. Now, in practice, a lot of people will wait 6 hours, 8 hours, check another set of LFTs, but it's certainly not wrong to go to an emergent ERCP. Now, what if you have a patient who looks well, okay, and looks pretty good, but has a mild, this is the second patient on this scenarios here, who has a mild liver-associated enzyme elevation and is doing pretty good. Now, that person should probably, before their gallbladder comes out, they should probably get a magnetic resonance MRI, MRCP to clear the duct before the gallbladder comes out. So that's a moderate risk patient. And then this is a third patient here who was extremely ill when you were called, okay, and looked kind of like the first patient where they were, you know, tachypneic and tachycardic and febrile, and they have a dilated duct, and they have a bilirubin of 3, and they have markedly elevated transaminases. But you were busy with a variceal bleed. The old liver docs were keeping you busy that night. And let's say it took an hour maybe or an hour or two for you to see them, and probably they got their labs done in triage in the ER, so their labs are now 5-6 hours old, and suddenly when you're on the way over to see this patient, they feel a lot better, and they feel relief, and they feel, whew, that feels a lot better. And now the ER is really worried about him because he looked sick, and they have another set of labs, and now the bili is 6, okay? Bili is higher, the transaminases are higher, but the guy looks good. When the patient looks better, even though the bilirubin's rising, because the bilirubin takes time, now you can say, okay, all right, you got a. You can watch this person because they're feeling better. The bilirubin, remember, the labs lag behind what's clinically going on. That person can be watched. Okay, I think we'll probably skip this scenario. This scenario I wanted to go with you as well. This is a very common scenario. Surgeons are often called in the middle of the night for these patients. I feel badly for them, but what happens is they tend to see a mild bilirubin elevation or even a fever, and they tend to immediately say, call gastroenterologists. So that means even later in the night, we're being called, and they often write on the chart, and then usually this is surgery house staff, I must say. And they usually say, you know what, you have somebody who's got a white count, somebody's got a bilirubin, they've got acute cholecystitis as well on ultrasound, and the surgeon writes on the chart, well, you know, we're going to take out the gallbladder, but you got to do an ERCP right now, tonight, urgent ERCP, they've got cholangitis, and I discussed it with my boss, with my surgery attending, we still need that done. Well, not necessarily, right? I mean, if the patient feels better and it's looking better, and they may have potentially passed the stone. So that's a common scenario where it's labeled on the chart, you must do an ERCP, but you don't necessarily have to do an ERCP. Use your head. If the patient's getting better, that's not necessarily the time to do an ERCP. All right, so alcohol etiology, so it's very important to think about a history. So social history, when you're talking to these patients, most patients sort of downplay their amount of drinking. That's one of the most key things with alcohol-related etiology. And I really worry about patients who come in with an alcohol-related etiology who've never had acute pancreatitis before. It's a naive gland. It has a lot of lipase and amylase that can that be released and cause more severe pancreatitis. So those patients you've got to watch very closely. And we'll skip most of this. Suffice it to say that if the lipase is very elevated, two times the amylase, that can indicate an alcohol etiology. Triglycerides, very important to realize in this day and age, triglyceride etiologies are increasing rapidly with our diabetic epidemic. A couple key points with triglyceride pancreatitis. Usually it's people who have triglycerides over 1,000. It is an endocrinologic emergency. Call an endocrinologist in the middle of the night if you need to. These patients can be plasmapheresis, especially if they have severe acute pancreatitis. I have seen it occur even in the 500 range. How that happens is patients often present 2 to 3 days into the process. They're nailed by mouth for 2 or 3 days. By that time, the triglycerides are a little bit better than they were beforehand. Alcohol can also falsely raise the triglycerides, which can cause some confusion. And keep in mind, patients with high triglycerides can have a normal amylase, normal lipase, because triglycerides interfere with the assay. And I have seen some lawsuits related to this where acute pancreatitis was not recognized in these patients. So key issue when you manage these patients with hypertriglyceride-induced pancreatitis is control the carbohydrates. It's the white carbohydrates that are the problem. It's the high glucoses that are the problem. Intravenous insulin may be necessary, maybe better than subcutaneous insulin. Usually carbohydrates are more the problem than the fats, although it's not always the case. Trauma, you can read through this at your will. Trauma can cause acute pancreatitis. Post-ERCP, I wanted to bring up a few points. Very common, post-ERCP pancreatitis is very common. So I wanted to highlight, how do you know, or how can you predict when somebody may have severe acute pancreatitis with who's got a post-ERCP etiology? And one of the key things is down here in this bottom point, which is there are three ways to predict it. There are procedure-related factors for acute pancreatitis post-ERCP. Proceduralist-related factors, who's doing the ERCP, how experienced are they, and then there are patient-related factors. Does the patient have more normal duct size? Normal ducts, never had pancreatitis before, that as patient with potential suspected sphincter of Vodi dysfunction, maybe a patient with an ampullary adenoma, a patient with a minor papilla, pancreas divisum and minor papilla cannulation. These are patient-related factors that lead to more severe acute pancreatitis. So it's nice when you see this patient, don't just say, oh, it's another post-ERCP patient. Try to think about, well, is it going to be severe? And the severe ones are the ones who have non-dilated ducts, usually younger women with normal previous pancreases, okay? And also keep in mind your ERCPist, and young inexperienced ERCPist may have more trouble. All right, so there are lots of other endoscopic causes of pancreatitis as well. I've caused it during deep enteroscopy, just doing enough of these, or even a diagnostic EUS can cause acute pancreatitis. If you're removing a duodenal adenoma, the heat from removing the duodenal adenoma can cause pancreatitis, so keep that on your differential. I just mentioned post-surgical pancreatitis for historical interest as well. This is typically post-bypass patients. Tumors can cause acute pancreatitis, and this is extremely important to think about. Another crucial point. If you see a so-called idiopathic acute pancreatitis in somebody who's over 50, or in somebody who's even young. I've seen it in 35-year-olds. I've heard of 28-year-olds with pancreatic cancer presenting as acute pancreatitis. So if somebody's got a family history, or you think they might have Lynch syndrome, they have maybe a uterine cancer and a colon cancer in a close relative, and, you know, this may be a young person with pancreatic cancer. So you must reimage these patients 6 to 8 weeks later to make sure the pancreatitis resolves. That's one of the key issues with neoplasia-induced pancreatitis. Dr. Ahmad is going to talk about pancreatic cysts and intraductal papillary mucinous neoplasms. Basically, this is mucin coming out of the major papilla and can cause acute pancreatitis. That's a normal papilla on the right. These are some pictures of pancreas divisum and the various types of pancreas divisum, and you can look through those, and we can talk about them later if you wish. Lots of drugs cause acute pancreatitis. This is a really important issue in this day and age, and lots of new drugs are coming out every day. The key thing is drug-induced pancreatitis, usually mild, okay? Couple drugs you have to keep in mind are not necessarily mild, and I want to highlight those. L-asparaginase, chemotherapeutic drug for leukemia, can cause very severe acute pancreatitis. Another one is the GLP-1 agonist for diabetics, exenatide, Byetta, down here we mentioned. Those can cause very severe acute pancreatitis. And anything that elevates the triglycerides, estrogens, Accutane, vitamin A, those are the more severe types of drug-induced pancreatitis. You can stratify acute pancreatitis from drugs by various issues, whether it's early or late, and what the cause is, but we won't get into that necessarily. There are plenty of infectious-related causes of acute pancreatitis. Sorry, I know this is dense. I hope you guys are keeping up with me. Oh, we got a couple more things to cover, and then I'll let you go. So there are exotic things that cause acute pancreatitis, Gila monsters, scorpions. We won't get into all that, but that's kind of interesting. Dr. Whitcomb's going to talk about the trypsin molecule and how it relates to hereditary pancreatitis. Suffice it to say, you can have hereditary pancreatitis, and he'll describe that in more detail. All right, some key points I really want to get through today. We all see acute pancreatitis, and we all basically what we are seeing, and usually it's mild acute pancreatitis, we're seeing the sleeping tiger. And we all get lulled into a false sense of security. We think all the tigers that we see are sitting in the Philadelphia Zoo or the Chicago Zoo or wherever you are, laying around, lazy, not doing anything, well-fed tigers. But you have to be on guard because every now and then this disease will bite you, and this is what happens, and you get necrotizing pancreatitis. So interstitial pancreatitis, usually mild, usually not a big deal, but you always have to be on guard because you cannot detect necrosis for 72 hours. It may take 2 to 3 days before you realize the patient has severe acute pancreatitis. That's why when the patient first presents, you have to almost treat them and try to predict, looking at the patient, who's going to have necrotizing pancreatitis and who's not. All right, so why it's important is 20% of people with necrotizing pancreatitis will die of the disease. That's a very high mortality, okay? And those that don't die stay in the ICU weeks and weeks and weeks, sometimes months, and have a long course. But we're all used to seeing the mild acute pancreatitis that has a low mortality of less than 1%, and we get lulled into a false sense of security. Once that necrotizing pancreatitis becomes infected, now you have a 50% mortality. So overall, acute pancreatitis has a 2 to 5% mortality. That's pretty high. That's worse than somebody with chest pain, okay? So what we're kind of doing here is trying to triage people into, okay, is it mild chest pain? Is it an NSTEMI? Is it a STEMI? And we don't have a real good way of doing that, unlike the cardiologist, but I'll try to outline how we can try to do that. Who's having the STEMI of the pancreas? Who's having a really bad attack? All right, so interstitial pancreatitis, here's a CAT scan. Here the pancreas is getting blood flow. It's bright, okay, it's getting contrast. That means it's alive. It's getting blood flow, okay? So that's interstitial pancreatitis. You see some swelling around the pancreas, some fluid around the pancreas. That patient's going to do fine. Another example of interstitial pancreatitis, again, although the pancreas is a little dark here, it's because it's lobular. It is actually getting contrast dye. It is getting blood flow, and 8 weeks later, the patient recovers, and you have a nice normal pancreas over here. I don't know if you can appreciate that. Here's necrotizing pancreatitis, a different scenario. Look at how bright the kidneys are, but the pancreas is dull. The pancreas is not getting any blood. It is swollen. It is so edematous that blood flow has been blocked off. Okay? And over here, 8 weeks later, now there's a cyst that necrosis, that mess, that pool of dead material has coalesced into a cyst, and it is pushing on the stomach. That's necrotic pancreatitis. Necrosis can be patchy. You can have pieces of necrosis here and there, and 8 weeks later you see it develop here with two little cysts developing. This is very severe necrotizing pancreatitis radiographically. You have a markedly distended belly on CAT scan, and here you have dead omentum material, dead pancreatic material, and 8 weeks later the patient survived out of the ICU barely. He was lucky to get out of the ICU, but here you have a large collection that's pushing on the stomach. Up here, the stomach is a little sliver. I don't know if you guys can appreciate that. So this collection is going to have to be drained. That patient's going to get nauseated. And here's an infected pancreatic necrosis. Here's a gangrene of the pancreas with gas bubbles in there. Very bad, very evil. All right, so how do patients die with acute pancreatitis? When you see your patient walking in the door with a lipase of 500 to 1,000, how's he going to die? How are we going to prevent death? So it's good to think about this. There are two peaks, mortality peaks. One's early, and the early peak is due to organ failure, okay? It's due to kidneys shutting down, ARDS. It's due to shock. It's due to hemorrhagic pancreatitis and bleeding. It's due to hypocalcemia and cardiac arrhythmias. It's due to pseudoaneurysm rupture and bleeding intraperitoneal, retroperitoneally. Now, late pancreatitis is a different animal. It's not so much due to organ failure. Late pancreatitis is you've got Humpty Dumpty, he's fallen off the wall, he's crashed or she's crashed, and now you got to put Humpty Dumpty back together again in the ICU. They're sitting around in the ICU, they're intubated, they're there 6 weeks. Now they get a Pseudomonas UTI, they get a MRSA pneumonia, they get hospital-acquired infections. And now, at this point, that's when you get infected necrosis, okay? Infected necrosis is very rare within the first 2, 3, 4 days. But infection can occur late on, and so it's important to understand those differences. Late on, also, patients get splenic vein thrombosis. They get gastric varices from pancreatitis, and those can bleed as well. Here's an example of hemosuccous pancreaticus that's bleeding from the pancreatic duct. That's from a pseudoaneurysm because of the inflammation around the splenic artery has ruptured the splenic artery. It's bleeding into the pancreatic duct. Okay, so what do I do when I look at a patient? How do I predict acute pancreatitis? And there are lots of fancy scoring systems to think about, but if you remember a few of these of my gestalt predictors, this will help you tremendously. So when you see a patient with acute pancreatitis, I worry about people who are a little bit on the bigger side. People are a little bit like apple phenotype. They have a lot of retroperitoneal fat. What that is that retroperitoneal fat is fuel for pancreatitis, okay? And that they make cytokines in that fat, and that is a worry. In fact, there is an Apache O score. So you can use an Apache score, which we'll talk about in a second, but if you add an O, which is the amount of obesity you have, now you have a much better predictor, actually, than the standard Apache score, okay? But patients who present hypotensive, tachycardic, orthostatic, who are not making urine. These are key clues, who are tachypneic, who have altered mental status, who have a pleural effusion. Don't downplay these little subtle things. A little pleural effusion could mean bad news. If the QTC is prolonged, that can mean hypocalcemia. It generally predicts mortality. If the patients have underlying comorbidities, somebody who's, not to pick on Dave Metz, but I will, somebody who's Dave Metz's age, and I'm sure he'll give me back, or Dr. Whitcomb's age, anything over 55, and I'm soon going to be in that territory as well, too. I don't know if you're quite over 55, but you have to worry about even middle-aged folks. That is a predictor of severity of acute pancreatitis. So so keep that in mind. Those patients have a low threshold to send them to ICU, somebody who just looks unwell. And a key point is anybody who's hemoconcentrated, and you give them a bunch of fluids with acute pancreatitis and they're still hemoconcentrated, their BUN is still elevated, even in spite of fluids, these are patients you probably, even if they look okay, you probably should send them to the ICU, especially to a place like the VA where you have a nursing ratio of one nurse to 12 patients, and you don't want that patient sitting in the back corner of the VA. You want the monitor in the ICU. All right, so there are lots of clinical indices of severity. We won't get into all of them. Suffice it to say they're interesting, they're good. The Ranson is a little bit cumbersome, takes a couple days. It was developed at NYU in the 1970s for alcoholic pancreatitis, but you can use it in all etiologies. Apache score, now we have an Apache 3 score, is a pretty good measure as well. And there's also the Atlanta criteria, and Atlanta criteria defines the severity of acute pancreatitis by organ failure. So if the organs are failing, now you have severe acute pancreatitis. And there's now a revised Atlanta, which says that it's not so much initial organ failure, but it's more permanence of the organ failure. But those are a little cumbersome, and they take a few days to really get those scores. They're more useful for researchers. And there's a bedside index of severity from Peter Banks. It's a real nice score because it has you look at the patient. If they have SIRS, systemic inflammatory response syndrome, if they're confused or at least mildly confused or stuporous, and if there's a pleural effusion, now bingo, you have a high score. You have to worry about that patient. Pretty easy test to do. I like the British, I guess it would be Northern Irish. This score is really nice. I like the fact that the albumin's included in this because it's the malnourished alcoholic with the first attack. Those folks you got to really worry about. This albumin is really critical, I believe. There's a Balthazar score, which is a radiographic score for predicting severity of acute pancreatitis. But keep in mind, I want to emphasize, if you take nothing away from today, realize that it takes 3 days for the radiographs to really pick up the severity of acute pancreatitis. By then, you already know. Patients in the ICU intubated doing poorly. So don't necessarily get a CAT scan early on. That's not going to help you in the first couple days. The time for a CAT scan is later on down the road because you can also ruin the kidneys when you do that. But the Balthazar score is good. What do I do when I see a patient and I'm making orders in the hospital? A couple key things. I make very strict parameters for when to call me. If there's a low-grade temp, if there's mild tachycardia over 100, if there's a drop in urine output, I want to know about it. And as a fourth-year fellow, it was my job to admit all patients with post-ERCP pancreatitis, so I did this quite a bit. So I tend to check finger sticks on every patient, even non-diabetics, every 4 hours when I'm on the floor with acute pancreatitis. And if their glucose is over 200 and they've never been a diabetic before, that's another sign that something's going wrong. It's an early indicator that you got to watch these patients closely. Give them lots of fluids, and we'll talk about what type of fluids. Another key thing with acute pancreatitis, I always get another basic metabolic panel about 6 hours after they come in and or a CBC. Because if you see that that BUN is rising or not getting better in spite of liters and liters of fluid, if you see that that hematocrit is not dropping, that's a bad sign. Jump on it. Send them to the ICU. Okay? But fluids, just a couple words on fluids. What we use now, the current data, and the data out there is very confusing. Retrospective studies show that giving lots of fluids is a problem. That's classic causality bias because these patients need lots of fluids. There's very little prospective randomized data. There was one study that showed probably in post hoc analysis, probably lactated ringers work better. So give a lot of fluids, give lactated ringers, but give it as boluses, okay? Just as if you're managing sepsis. Bolus, 500 cc's, bolus, 1,000 cc's. Wait, see, watch the urine output. Don't just put people on 500 cc's an hour and watch them, okay? Or if the patient comes in late, that is not necessarily the time to load them with fluids if they're coming in late, okay? We talked about when to do a CAT scan. Nutrition, anybody with severe acute pancreatitis, if it's severe acute pancreatitis, drop a DOP off and try to get it beyond the ligament of Treitz and start feeding them. We know that if you feed people enterally within 48 hours of presentation, they do better. We try to avoid TPN as much as possible. The reality is it's very difficult to do that in these very sick patients. It's hard to feed them in the stomach as well because they get bloated, they have an ileus, and some of these patients do actually need TPN. You can try elemental feeds or medium chain triglycerides as well. When to use antibiotics, usually you try to avoid antibiotics unless you have you can prove that there's infected necrosis, and that can be very hard to do. And we just have listed here which type of bugs can cause this. When should IR drain a collection in acute pancreatitis? Generally speaking, you avoid IR drainage unless the surgeons are involved and really want it. And ideally, the IR doc should take a retroperitoneal approach. The Dutch pioneered this. It's called VARD. It's where the IR puts a catheter through the left back. And we've shown in randomized controlled trials through the Dutch that works better. When you randomize patients to laparotomy for infected necrosis or IR-based approach, IR-based approach does better. Just involve your surgeons in this decision-making. It's really critical. And so it used to be, by the way, that everybody with infected necrosis got operated on. So this was a landmark study, the PANTER trial, 4 years ago, showing that IR-based approaches, and now we know endoscopic-based approaches are probably better than surgery as well, too. Key point in management, don't stick drains in things unless they're mature. Wait 8 weeks. Don't try to tap these collections. Let them mature. Support the patient in the ICU if you have to. If it means 8 weeks, 10 weeks in the ICU, that's okay. Try to prolong the time lengthen the time that you manage them conservatively. That makes it much easier for the surgeons eventually down the road. All right, so we went through our key points. We'll have to skip some of our scenarios here. Just want to go through my key take-home points, which is understanding the causes and presentation of acute pancreatitis and know who's going to be a problem patient when you're looking at the patient. Somebody who's got SIRS and systemic inflammatory response, who looks unwell, who has hypotension, those are patients you got to watch carefully. Give lots of fluids, give it as boluses, generally use lactated ringers unless they have renal dysfunction, and don't hesitate to send patients to the ICU. Know who's got the Garmin bile duct stone, who's going to need an ERCP urgently, based on what I was describing. Patients who have cholangitis, who have biliary obstruction, they need urgent ERCP. And remember, these patients need their gallbladder out at some point. And also remember, the two mortality peaks, there's an early mortality peak and a late mortality peak, and why that occurs in acute pancreatitis, I think that's really key in managing these patients, and know when to call a surgeon, when to call an interventional radiologist. And with that, you will keep your pancreas happy, and I will keep Dr. Metz and Brenda Paul happy, so that's what we all want, right? So I know it's a lot of stuff to talk about. There's a lot in your syllabus. These are really key points. I'm all ears. I have my contact information in there. Feel free to contact me anytime. And I think we may have to save questions until the end, or do you want to take some questions now? Or?
I think we can maybe take some questions until the end. Hopefully we'll be able to keep our panel discussion.
And I feel fortunate that I actually gave my presentation before Dr. Whitcomb, because giving a presentation after Dr. Whitcomb is quite difficult. So thanks.